My name is Bob Darrow, and I am alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
And I'm sober today only through the grace and power of God in the program, in the people, and in the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's been a great weekend up to right about now. I get nervous when people look at me. I don't know what this is. This is supposed to be therapeutic. I'd like to thank Ken and Shirley for picking me up at the airport, and Cliff, your chairman, for all and the rest of the committee, just a tremendous hospitality that I've received this weekend. Actually, Cliff R., who's your Sunday morning speaker, actually was the initial person that called me, and he called me up and he said that one of our speakers got sick and can't make it, and we've called every good speaker we could think of. And haven't had any luck, and so always a bridesmaid, never a bride. There's no doubt in my mind that I'm here by divine appointment. And that's something we batter around in AA, and you hear that said, but there's some things that have happened to me this weekend that where I know beyond a shadow of a doubt I'm here by divine appointment. When I got that call, they said that I could bring a guest, and George is one of the guys, he's with me that I sponsor. He's been having some relationship problems. I know you guys don't have those down here. And he was just planning on sitting around this weekend and thinking. So you probably saved his life. Steve, who there's a bunch of us that came down. Steve, who came down. It was such a touching thing that he, as a result of coming down here and going to this conference, he got to see his mother and make some amends to her and open a door to a relationship with her. And he hadn't seen his mother. She lives down here in 15 years. And then on Thursday night, I'm here, and one of the first I get introduced to Peter F. up here, and I'm looking at him. Now, I've heard stories in Alcoholics Anonymous about, you know, when you run into people you used to drink with and get high with, and it never happened to me. Peter and I were roommates in college. Unbelievable. And that's back in the day. We thought we were gangsters. The police thought we were public nuisances. I know there's a lot of new people here. I'm real glad you're here. I may be more glad you're here than you are, because I know the tremendous things that can happen to guys who suffer from alcoholism, like I suffer from it, the things that can happen to us in these rooms if we just come back here and work a few steps and get a sponsor and buy this package called Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an amazing thing. I think that, for me personally, I think I was born with alcoholism. I think before I ever took a drink, I was like a freeze-dried alcoholic waiting for alcohol. And I think that because of from what you've taught me about alcoholism, I look back over my life and I had all the predisposition. The big book says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And when I look back over my childhood, basically all I can really remember is me, pretty much. I remember me. I remember everything that had to do with me. I can't tell you what my mom struggled with or what she was anxious about, unless it had to do with me, but I can tell you all about me. I mean, and I was that way. My mom used to say to me as a little kid, she said, "Rob, you're full of yourself." And I didn't get it. You know, I didn't until I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor has me reading that portion of the big book from 60 to 63, and I'm like, geez, I don't know what my mom was talking about. Selfishness, self-centered, self-absorbed, that's me. I was that way from a little kid. And I didn't come from an alcoholic home. And it's become almost maybe the norm, or at least it's very, you hear it so often in Alcoholics Anonymous, members of AA who came from alcoholic homes. And my parents, I don't know if they even drank. I think they might have had a cocktail once in a while. I don't know. I never remember anybody drinking in my household. There was a lot of love there. I got a lot of attention. We did a lot of things together as a family. I was never yelled at or beaten or anything as a kid. I knew intellectually that I was loved, but there was something about me that I couldn't feel it. My sister could feel it, but there was something about me, like I was so self-absorbed that it couldn't get in. And even no matter how much my parents loved me, it had no effect. I was like the black hole of love. I mean, nothing could touch me because I was so wrapped up in myself. And I'll tell you a little story. When I was about 3 or 4 years old, maybe, I was just a toddler. I went with my folks one Sunday afternoon to this farmer's market back east. We live in Pennsylvania. It was outside of town. It was where all the farmers brought their produce and their wares to sell to the public. And on the way in there, my dad's bragging to my mom about this horseradish that this one farmer makes that has won all these awards. It's super hot, very strong, powerful horseradish. My dad loves stuff like that. And I'm going in there with him and my mom, and I'm listening to him brag about this, and he got some, and I asked him, I said, "Papa, can I have some?" And he said to me, he says, "Rob, you can't have it. It's too strong. It's only for adults. You just can't have it." Now, I'm one of those kind of kids that I may not even really want something until you tell me I can't have it. And then you tell me I can't have it, I gotta have it. To this day, I can barely make it through a do not touch wet paint sign without touching it. You know what I mean? I just gotta touch it. It's just in my nature to be like that. And I waited till my folks weren't around and I snuck in that kitchen. I got that jar of horseradish out of that refrigerator, got a big spoon, sat on the floor of that kitchen, got that lid off, stuck that spoon in my mouth. It's before LSD, but I think I saw God that morning. I'm not sure. Snot's pouring out of my nose and tears are running down my face. I spewed horseradish all over that kitchen. I got awful, 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 awful sick. Awful sick, awful sick. Now, that was a lot of years ago, and I have not once sat with a jar of horseradish and a big spoon, didn't have to go to no rehab, get no sponsor, go to no meetings, work no 12 steps. But I gotta tell you, square business, that if that horseradish would have made me feel like alcohol made me feel, I probably would have spent the rest of my life making myself sick with horseradish every chance I could get. Because I was born with a spiritual predisposition to alcoholism. There was something inside of me that just needed to be filled up. There was a vacancy inside of me that I never knew I had until the first time I drank. And the first time I ever drank alcohol, I was about 12 years old. And it made me feel so good that the way I felt without it was never really okay again. Never really. And I lived to get high. And I got in a lot of trouble the very first time I ever drank. I had a blackout. Got in trouble with the guys I was with. Got in trouble with my folks. And I just, you'd think I'd have stopped, but I found something that I needed to, it did something for me I needed to have done. For the first time in my life, I felt like other people looked. For the first time in my life with those kids I was with for that first 20 minutes or a half hour, I didn't have to pretend anymore that I was cool. I didn't have to pretend anymore that I fit. I really fit. It created a sense and an illusion of wholeness in me that I needed so desperately, and I didn't even need it until it was, I needed it until it was done. And once it was done, I spent the rest of my life trying to seek that sense of ease and comfort and that sense of wholeness that I'd found in drinking, and I almost killed me in the pursuit of that. But alcoholism's a disease of diminishing returns. And you know, you start out, if you're like I am, you start out and you're drinking and there's a tremendous amount of fun, tremendous amount of effect. It really does something for me. Little bit of problems. And as time goes on, the problems increase and the fun and the effect diminish until at the very end, I've lost everything. And I'm desperately trying to wring some kind of fun and some kind of effect out of that thing, hoping against hope that maybe this time I'll be able to drink and go down to that Skid Row bar, and maybe this time I'll be able to talk to some people, and maybe I'll feel like I fit, and maybe I won't have to sit in this god-awful loneliness that I seem to walk with no matter what I do or where I go. But towards the end of my drinking, alcohol wouldn't do that for me. About the year after I met Peter, I ended up my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I was in a spiritual cause and effect. And I was in an institution. And I didn't want to go to that meeting. I was, but the people had the keys, thought it was a good idea that I went there. So I went to this Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Now, I'm a young kid. I don't even think I turned 21 yet. I don't even think I was old enough for a legal drink. And I'm sitting in this Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and man, the people in there, they're old. There's people there 35 years, 40 years old, their life's over with. No wonder they come to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm a young guy, and I just didn't feel like I fit there. Plus, if you grew up on the streets that I grew up on and the time that I grew up, and you were an alcoholic of my type, and ran with those people, we were also chemically well-balanced people. I mean, we did a lot of things other than alcohol. It doesn't mean I'm less of an alcoholic. It was just part of the times I grew up in. And I went through that phase as a kid growing up. And so I'd sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous as a young kid, and I didn't hear anybody talking about that, and I used that to think that I was different. See, I was the kind of guy that if you invited me into your house, I'd ask to use the bathroom, and I'd just go through the medicine cabinets. And I'd take whatever's there. I don't even need to know what it is, really. Sometimes I'd be up for days saying the same thing over and over again, chewing my tongue. Other times I'd be falling down, bouncing off the wall. Sometimes I'd just get real regular. I probably took enough pills out of those wheels. There's no chance I'm going to be pregnant this century. But I looked at all that stuff, and I didn't hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about that. And I thought, I'm different. My case is different. And also, the people in AA stopped drinking, and you guys were just happy. Happy, happy, happy people. I mean, you loved everybody. You were grateful for everything, And I stopped drinking, and man, I feel like a fish out of water. Abstinence to me feels like I'm doing time. I don't feel like that. And I came to the conclusion that I'm not like you. I'm different from you people. From 1971 to 1978, I was in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot of times through institutions, and this spiraled down into oblivion that guys like me follow. I was an unprotected alcoholic. I didn't have a business or a family. My family stopped bailing me out. And I was one of those guys. I was all alone on the streets, just going down and down and down. And I come into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous many times through those years. I went to a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm the alcoholic that they talk about in the Big Book, but it's very hard for me to see that. In the Big Book, it talks about guys like me. Silkworth says something that when I started to understand it, I started to feel like I fit a little bit here. Silkworth says that guys like me have an allergy to alcohol. But unlike other allergies, when I drink, I don't break out in hives. I break out in what Silkworth calls a phenomenon of craving. And I would sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would listen to people talk about this phenomenon of craving, but I can't see that applies to me. I mean, I drink, and I drink and get drunk, and I always drink and get drunk. I mean, that's what I do. But it didn't seem like a craving to me. I mean, I saw Days of Wine and Roses and The Lost Weekend, and I don't claw the walls to get another drink. It didn't apply to me. But the funny thing about a craving is you don't realize you have it until it's interrupted. And my drink, I never allowed my drinking to be interrupted. I would not go. I mean, if you said, come over to my house and we're going to spend the day working in the yard and we'll split a six-pack of beer, I'm not going to show up. Yeah. You say, I got five cases, I'm there an hour early. I mean, but I don't put myself in situations where I can only have two and then I can't get any more. Now, I don't do that because I think I'm alcoholic. It's just sort of an intuitive thing with me, There's a test in the Big Book, and the test says, if you don't think you're an alcoholic, try some controlled drinking. Try to go over, step up to the nearest bar, try to drink and stop abruptly, and try it more than once. Well, that sounds real good, but I don't think that's a viable test for a guy like me. I would go into a bar, I would have two drinks, and it would become all of a sudden very clear that this is just not a good test day. I mean, it's a good test. nice test, but there would I would be it become real clear to me this is not the day for the test, that tomorrow is a much better day for the test. And I'd never do that test. I mean, because when I start drinking, it's like something turns in my head, and all of a sudden I come up with very plausible reasons to have another drink, and they make sense to me. I mean, I thought them. They should. I mean, all my thinking makes sense to me, unfortunately. That's why I have a sponsor. My speaking always makes sense to me. So I'm going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started to hear people talk about this phenomenon of craving, but I don't get it, really. And you know, the beauty and the power of Alcoholics Anonymous lies in identification. See, no one in AA has ever tried to tell me what I was. They just, because you can't do that with me. And if you're like me, people probably have been trying to tell you, or you're an alcoholic, or you're this or that. And what happens if you try to tell me about me like that, I just have certain automatic knee-jerk reaction defense mechanisms that come into play. And I just shut you out. You can't get to me that way. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, nobody tried to tell me about me. I'd be sitting in the back of the room and you'd be talking about yourself. So my defense mechanisms are down. And I'm starting to identify, and I was listening to this woman share about her experience with the phenomenon of craving, and I remembered something that had happened to me when I was about 18 years old. And now, when I was 18 years old, in my mind, there was no way I was an alcoholic. When I was 18 years old, I was going through my long-haired, hippie stage of my alcoholism, right? But the alcoholism doesn't care how long your hair is. It doesn't make any difference. And I'm dating this gal, and she invited me over to her house to meet her family for an all-night dinner. And I hate stuff like that. You know, you feel like you're under the microscope, but I'm trying to be a good guy, and I went. And at the dinner table, they brought out a bottle of wine. Now, it wasn't a big bottle, just a fifth. And they opened the bottle of wine, and I drink quickly. I don't know what that's, evaporation must be some childhood issue with me or something. I don't know what that's about. But I drink quickly, and because I drink quickly, I get two glasses out of this bottle of wine, and I finish the two glasses. They're still sipping on their first glass, and I'm sitting there. I got two glasses of wine in me. I don't know anything about alcoholism or phenomenon of craving or physical allergy, but I'm sitting there, and I want another glass of wine. And I'm sitting there, and I'm a little antsy. I finally told him. I said, you know, that was really good wine. Do you have any more? And they said no, and they went back to talking, and I'm sitting there. Now, I'm going to be stuck there for the rest of the evening, and I'm sitting there, and I'm getting a little squirrely. I'm getting a little fidgety, and I finally blurted out, sure like beer. They said, well, that's nice, Bob. We don't have any more beer. And they went back to talking about Vietnam and sports and all this kind of crap, and I'm sitting there, and I got two glasses of wine in me, and I think I'm going to lose my goddamn mind, and I don't know what's wrong with me. I finally excused myself, went to the bathroom, locked the door, rummaged through their cabinets and everything, found a bottle of cough medicine, 35% alcohol with codeine and terpene hydrate, sat down on the edge of the bathtub, chugged that thing, got what it talks about in the 12 concepts, singleness of purpose. All the voices in my head just got real focused and real, they all kind of got together in a cheering section and all in the same direction, and the direction was, let's get you out of here. And I went back out to that dinner table, and by then I had a story about this deal I forgot to take care of, and I was very apologetic, and I was sorry I have to leave, and they were sorry I had to leave, and we'll come back and do this again, yes. And I went and got in my car, drove like a gentleman, 20, 25 miles an hour, turned the corner, went 80 miles an hour like a maniac to get to a guy's house that I knew who had a bar in the basement because I had two glasses of wine. It lit something up inside of me that demanded attention. Now, I was the only person at that dinner table who was alcoholic, because other people have been alcoholic. We'd all been in that goddamn bathroom looking through those cabinets. But something happens to me when I drink that doesn't happen to those people. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978, and I finally bought it by now. I know that I can't take a drink. I know that I didn't know the words. I don't know the terminology, phenomenon of craving, because I haven't studied the book yet. But I knew from the reality of my experience that I'm one of those kind of guys, I take a drink and I'm done. I don't know where it's going to just keep going. It keeps feeding itself. But I secretly suspected that everybody who drinks must surely get that same fired up feeling wanting more. It just made sense to me. I just thought that for some reason, people like my sister or some people that don't have a problem with it, they can control it. And Silkworth says that's not true. He says normal people, non-alcoholic people, never experience that phenomenon of craving. It is an alien experience to them. And it was hard for me to understand that because, as Silkworth also says, that guys like me, my alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I just assume that everybody drinks like I drink, that everybody gets the same effect from alcohol that I get. Silkworth says that isn't true. And I didn't really get that until I was about 4.5 years sober. And I got it by watching a non-alcoholic drink. I was dating this gal who wasn't an alcoholic, and we'd go out to dinner, and she'd order a drink, and I swear to God, it would take her a half hour to drink one drink. I mean, she would take a sip and then talk for 10 minutes. I would sit there and watch the ice melt. That's like alcohol abuse, you know what I mean? That's like... I remember one time she told me this story, and I must have looked at her like she was from Mars. She said she was at this party, and somebody had gave her a marijuana cigarette. And she took a couple hits off of it, and she was saving it for New Year's Eve. I mean, why? The whole time I knew her, I never once saw her finish two drinks. She would order a second drink many times. She'd drink a third of it, a quarter of it, a half of it, whatever, and she'd do the most incredible, bizarre thing you've ever seen. She'd push it aside, and she'd say, "I don't want it anymore. I'm starting to feel it." Let me tell you, it'd be easier for me to have sex and after two strokes say, "I don't want any more of that. I'm starting to feel it," than it would be to do that with two drinks of alcohol. And I started to see from her experience with alcohol that I'm really different from her. You see, my friend, when she pushed the second drink away, she was not trying to prove a point to me. We're all capable of doing that. You know, when your mate's on your back or your boss is on your back or your folks are on your back and you're out to dinner with them, we are capable on occasion to have two to show them. Can't do it a lot. And we usually got to go get lit up later that day. But we can do it to show them. But my friend's not trying to prove nothing to me. When she took two drinks, she got a feeling like she's losing control. I take two drinks, I get a feeling like I'm getting control. It does something fundamentally different to me, down to the essence of my spirit. It lights something up inside of me that demands attention. And that's why I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I'm an alcoholic. But if that was the only aspect of this disease, I'd have probably got sober in 1971. But there's another aspect of this disease, and it's what kills guys like me. And it kills guys like me, and I don't even know what's doing it to me. And that is that I am the type of alcoholic that when I stop drinking, for all practical purposes, that's where my alcoholism begins. It's where the bottle and the bag ends. And I didn't understand this. I would get there in the later years, and the last 2 or 3 years I was in and out, I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd be desperate. And I would stop drinking and I would go to your meetings and I would listen to you, and I couldn't fit here. I had a really hard time in AA. See, I know what it's like to sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and die of untreated alcoholism. And it's that sick, sick, lonely feeling where you sit there and it's like it's all of you and then there's me. And I'm apart and separate, and it just breaks my heart. It's the one place you would think I would feel like I fit, and I didn't even fit here. Because what I observed in Alcoholics Anonymous, I observed people who quit drinking and they were comfortable. You could tell. They had great relationships. They were successful at whatever businesses they were involved in. They were happy. They laughed a lot. They had some real appreciation of their life. And I quit drinking, and I'm none of that. I quit drinking, and I feel like a fish out of water. I quit drinking, and I'm what Silkworth talks about. I become restless, irritable, and discontent. I'm restless in a sense that I can never feel settled anywhere, really. I never really feel like I'm okay and in the right place. Wherever I am, whatever I'm doing, I just know I should be somewhere else doing something else. I can't tell you what that somewhere else is and what that something else is, but it just is never here. It is never really here where I am. And I'm irritable. You take alcohol out of my life, and I get on the muscle around people. I don't mean to, but I get so uptight around people. And I'm either just real cocky and aggressive and pushy, or else I'm real withdrawn and kind of distant. And everybody thinks I'm stuck up, and I'm really just terrified. And people rub me the wrong way. Life rubs me the wrong way, and I don't know how to change that. I don't know how to be different. And I'm discontent. I'm the kind of guy, I think you could give me a brand new Rolls Royce, and in 3 weeks it's the wrong color. Nothing seems to fill up that hole. Nothing. And Silkworth says we're that way unless we can again experience the sense of ease and comfort we'd once found in taking a few drinks. And I become an ease and comfort junkie. And I get sober, and I get a case of the when eyes, you know. I feel awful, and I don't feel right, and I don't feel like the people in AA, and something's wrong with me, and I don't know what it is. And I look around, and I see a job. I see this guy. He's working at this fast steel mill, man, and he's making tremendous money. I mean, phew. And he's got a lot of, he's happy, you can tell. And I become obsessively convinced, man, if I had that job, that'll be it, man. I'll be happy then. I'm not happy now, but when I have that job, man, I'll be happy. What happens is I get the job. And then what happens to me is that 3 weeks or 6 months or 3 months or whatever period of time goes by, and all of a sudden, on a subconscious emotional level, I start to compare what it feels like to have that job to what it felt like to take 5 shots of Jack Daniels, and all of a sudden, this job sucks. I start realizing how they're taking advantage of me, and I'm not getting paid enough, and I'm working harder than everybody else, and on. Pretty soon, I'm the guy that's leaving. Or I see that gal across the room, you know, and I think, man, my friend Bill's married, man, he's really happy. If I had that gal over there and I could settle down like Bill and I had that going for me, man, she's incredible. God, with her, pigeons would fly out my ears. I know it. And what happens is I get together with her, and in 3 weeks or 3 months or 6 months later, I start to subconsciously compare what it feels like to be with her to what it felt like to have 5 shots of Jose Cuervo, and now I don't want to be with her anymore. And I start blaming her for my emptiness. And I start becoming dissatisfied and trying to find fault with her. Because I have alcoholism. I have a spiritual malady that really starts where the bottle ends. I think sometimes to have alcoholism is like being destined to walk through life with a stone in your shoe. And it's a very small stone, like a mild, vague irritant. And you just stop periodically, and you take your shoe off, and you shake it out, and you rub it out, and you put it back on, and there it is again, you know. It's just, something isn't right, you know, and it's just, and if you're like I am, you go to foot clinics, and foot doctors, and foot psychologists, and you chant at your foot, and you find doctors that anesthetize your foot, but the anesthetic wears off, and there you are again, walking along, this little mild irritant in your shoe. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978, at the end of my rope, surrender to this simple program, and I come in here with an illusion. That the illusion is that what Alcoholics Anonymous is probably about one day when I really do the steps right, or I've sponsored whatever my quota is in heaven for people to sponsor, or I've made the ultimate surrender, and, you know, not like the other ones that I thought were the ultimate, but they're real, you know, they're real. When I get that all of a sudden the stone will be gone once and for all, for good. And I tell you, just in the last 4 or 5 years, I've come to understand that that's not what Alcoholics Anonymous is about at all. Alcoholics Anonymous is not about getting the stone out of my shoe once and for all. Alcoholics Anonymous is about hooking up with a whole lot of people that all have stones in their shoes, and I get so caught up listening to them whine about their stones in their shoe for long periods of time that I don't realize I got one in my shoe. But you give me 20 minutes to contemplate my life, and it just comes... I remember this truth. This is the truest example of alcoholism I ever experienced, and I was new in sobriety probably a year and a half, 2 years, maybe even two and a half, somewhere in the first couple years. And I got off work. I had a great day at work, really a good day. I was productive. I was out of myself. I went and had a coffee and something to eat with a bunch of guys in AA, and I'm going to this late night meeting, and I'm walking into the meeting. The meeting's about to start, and there's this old timer in AA there. And he looks at me, he gives me one of those right in the eye looks, you know, where they look deep into your soul, you know. And he says to me, "Bob, how are you doing? How are you really doing?" And I sat down in that meeting and I thought, holy shit. You know, now that I think about it, I don't feel very good. You know, I was telling him what a great job I have. That job, this really, now that I think about it, is awful. And I could look around the room and everybody's doing better than I am. You know, and I just sunk right into this abyss. You know, I mean, just a bit. And yet, if you're around Alcoholics Anonymous and you're active for a long time, you've also had the reverse experience, where you're full of fear or frustration, or you're scared, or things are happening that are just frustrating you to just feel like you're going to go crazy. And you hook up with some new guy that's coming off a drunk, or some guy that you sponsor that's really having a tough time, and you start listening to them, and all of a sudden I feel wonderful. And all of a sudden I don't even remember what it was that's bugging me. And when Dr. Bob in his last talk said that Alcoholics Anonymous boils down to love and service, I think that's really right. I was so happy to see that in the inside of your program. That's one of the most beautiful talks in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's so simple and so to the point. Alcoholics Anonymous does boil down to love and service. I was really fortunate, and I'm going to tell you how I got to AA and then what's happened to me. What brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978 is not what you would think. About 6 months before I got sober, I was in a halfway house, and I was in there because I was homeless. I'd been homeless for a long time. I ended up one of those kind of guys. I became one of those guys that you see in every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous has a guy like me. I was the guy with the really long matted hair that would come in and out of AA, and you just knew he's going to die, he's never going to get sober, because I'd been doing that for years. And in 1977, I was in this halfway house, and I stayed sober about as long as I could stand it, and I went on a drunk with this guy, and he was letting me sleep on his couch in this little shabby trailer. And we came home from drinking one night, and he passed out, and I ain't done drinking yet because I'm still awake. And I'm one of those kind of drunks. If I'm awake, I ain't done drinking. And he left his car keys and his wallet on the kitchen counter. Now, I'm not a thief, but I do know when a loan is appropriate. And I made a little loan out of this guy's wallet, and I took his car, and I went out to finish the deal because my fuse is still lit. And I got arrested for a felony DUI, hit and run in a stolen car. I was put into the county jail in Pennsylvania. I could not make bail. I don't know what bail bondsmen have this thing about, you're supposed to have an address. I don't know what that's about, but they don't go for people who don't have an address, and I couldn't make bail. I sat in that county jail for several months. I went before a judge who knew everything about me. He had my whole record there, all the treatment centers, all the arrests, everything. And he told me something. He looked at me and he told me about all this stuff I was, and he painted a picture of me as being a guy that was really kind of hopeless. And he sentenced me to 2 years in the state penitentiary. And he did something that was very unusual. He stayed the commitment. After he sentenced me, he says, "We're not going to carry out this commitment just now. The PO department has gotten you into a place called the Ark House on the north side of Pittsburgh, and it's the only place that will take you, and it was. I'd been in all the other places. And it wasn't really a rehab, it was a place that housed homeless guys, winos like me. He said, the judge said, if you go in there for a year and you get good UAs, good PO report, make the restitution, do everything you're supposed to do, you come back before me on this date and you may or may not have to do the 2 years depending upon what you do in there that in this next year. And I went into that place and I went into that place with a determination not to drink. And I got to tell you something, if a determination was enough to overcome alcoholism, I would have gotten sober at that moment. But I'm the alcoholic that it talks about in the big book, lack of power is my dilemma. And I went in there and I'm hanging on because, for one, winter's coming on and I have no place to go. And if I drink, I'm going to be out in the snow. And I did that before, walked those streets all night long to keep from sitting down, because if you sit down, you fall asleep. And if you fall asleep and it's 5 degrees out, you're dead. So I'm hanging on by my fingernails. I don't want to do the 2 years in prison. I don't jail well. Some people jail well. I don't like it. I sit in there and wonder, what's a nice guy like me doing with all these maniacs, you know? And everybody else is in there looking at me and the other guys going, what's a nice guy, you know? I don't like jail. I don't like being on the muscle all the time. I don't like to have to put up that facade and act like something I'm not. I hated it. So I'm in this place called the Ark House, and I'm hanging on by my fingernails, but I'm restless, I'm irritable, and I'm discontent, and I got a drink coming at me, and I know it's coming at me. I can see it. I can feel it, because I've been down this road anymore. I've just about had it up to here with this abstinence, and I can't stand it anymore. It's not that I want to go to jail. It's not that I want to get thrown out of there. It's not that I want to destroy myself. I'm getting to the point where I just have to do something to change the way I feel, because I cannot stand the desolation of this untreated alcoholism 1 minute more. And I'm in an in-house meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm getting ready to jump. And after the meeting, I grabbed this old timer in AA, and I did something I'd never did before. I became vulnerable in front of another human being. And I said, I need to talk to somebody. And I sat down with this guy, and I told him everything that was going on to me in the limited way I could explain it. I told him about the 2 years of prison I was facing. I told him about the years of failures at trying to stay sober. I tried to describe the way I felt. I had these emotional problems that didn't make any sense. I was the kind of guy, I could be sitting in the TV room doing fine, and then all of a sudden I would feel so depressed, I almost suicidal, and nobody's even said anything to me. I would just go on these roller coaster rides, and they're just driving me crazy. I got mental problems. I don't know what's wrong, but my head, I just chatter to myself, all this bizarre, crazy stuff in my head all the time. You know, about every other day, I've got some kind of terminal disease or something. You know, it's just, and my head's just constantly telling me what a worthless piece of crap I am. And oh, it's awful. It's like, you take alcohol out of my life, and living with my mind is like traveling cross country in a van full of 8-year-olds that have overdosed on sugar, and none of them like you. It's just, you know, what if, Bob? What if, you know, all this, it's just nuts. And I'm telling him about, I can't work. I can get a job. I get good jobs. But I'm always the guy they're calling into the office, and they're saying things to me like, Bob, you're a hard worker, but we got to let you go. There's something wrong with your attitude. I said, what? What do you mean attitude? I don't get it. Or they say things to me like, I hear this a lot. Bob, you're a hard worker, but we're going to have to let you go because you're not a team player. Well, yeah, okay. Sober, I'm not a team player. Give me a pint of vodka, I'll lead your damn team. Sober, I don't fit very well. I don't feel like those people at work. I don't mix well with people. And I can't work. I got all these problems. I got all this shame and guilt from the things I did to some really nice people. Man, I did some irreputable damage and just awful stuff to some beautiful people just because they were there, and my insanity. I don't know this guy, and I says, I need help, man. I'm getting ready to drink. I can feel it. I don't want to drink. You got to help me do something. And on the wall of the meeting room is a thing with the 12 steps. And this guy gives me his business card, and he says, He says, if you'll put those 12 steps, if you'll do those, and I'll help you if I can, your life will change. All this stuff will take care of itself. And he gets up and he walks way to the back of this long hall where the meeting is, and to get coffee. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking to myself, I've seen these steps before on the walls, but I better really read them this time. I start reading them, and it became really apparent to me that this guy hadn't heard anything I just told him. There's nothing in those steps that corresponds to any of my problems. Nothing. I mean, nothing at all. I mean, you could stretch your imagination. I mean, it's not that I had a problem with the steps. They were nice, kind of altruistic, neat things. If I ever got my life together, I'll work those steps. Hey, I might join a gym, too. I don't know. But this doesn't apply to my set of problems. See, I need a set of steps like step one, make Bob's police record disappear. Step two, bring her back properly ashamed of herself. Step three, give me $1,000. Step four, make my folks realize how wrong they've been about me. Or give me a step to where I can sleep at night. Give me a step where I feel good. Give me a step that's going to turn off this insanity in my head. But no, we got stuff, one of my personal favorites. Turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. I was raised as a Catholic. Now, I can't blame the Catholic Church. I got to tell you that what I heard may not have been said. And I say that because there are kids I went to school with that are still Catholics. And if they heard what I... See, I heard about this God that exists to judge me. And he can see in the dark. That's not good for a guy like... That's a bad, bad deal. He can read my mind. He can read all my thoughts, that's a hideous concept. I mean, I'm always thinking weird stuff. The nuns, as a little kid, the nuns used to say, you got to be pure of thought, word, and deed. And they'd do that in X-rated movies and just start going through my head. You know? And I'd go, oh, no, don't think that. Oh, no, God, I'm going to go to hell. And sometimes I'd imagine what the nuns looked like underneath their habits. And then, oh, no, this is really, I'm screwed now. Jeez, oh, God, man, I'm in a lot of trouble. God, there can't be a God. And then this priest tells me, he says, well, God's created a place for people like you that never write. It's called purgatory. And in purgatory, it's sort of like hell. They burn you and torture you, and it's awful. But purgatory only lasts for a couple hundred million years, maybe. You know, I remember getting to be 12 years old, and I don't want to offend anyone, I learned about masturbation. I could picture this meter in heaven clicking off the millions of years, and I haven't even done anything yet, I'm just practicing, So I'm sitting in there, I read this step, turn your will and your life over to the care of God. I'd rather turn it over to a narcotics agent. And then my personal favorite, making amends. Oh. You guys in AA, I could look around alcoholics. You should make amends. That's a good deal for you. I bet you some of you got a little too drunk one night, said something unkind to your wife. You should go apologize. Maybe you padded your expense account. Take care of that too. I lived on the streets like an animal. I was the kind of guy that if you felt sorry for me and told me I could sleep on your couch when you went to work, I robbed you. I mean, it wasn't personal. I mean, it was just the way I was. I mean, one time, to save my own butt, I dined out all these guys in this outlaw motorcycle gang to keep from going to prison. I could just picture myself making amends, going up to this guy that just got out of prison. It's ahead of this out. Well, Cheech, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to say, I'm sorry I dimed you out and you had to do the 10 years. I might as well just put a gun to my head. You know? What? I mean, so the guy comes back to the table and I'm looking at the steps and I just got up and I said, I'll see you later. And I went back up to my room and about 2 or 3 days later, I started my last drunk. I didn't know it was to be my last drunk. See, that guy had laid the program of Alcoholics Anonymous at my feet. It had been laid at my feet, this simple kit of spiritual tools, many times. But I am the type of alcoholic that I go on a run and alcohol takes everything away from me. I end up in Alcoholics Anonymous and the first thing I get back is my damn opinion. And it is my opinion and my judgment that kept me away from what you have here. I was so full of stuff in here that I thought I knew that I couldn't learn anything new. I was what the experience was like. It was like walking downtown, wherever all the homeless people are, and having some guy come out of the weeds that's with matted down hair, that's got four or five layers of clothes on, that's been obviously homeless for a long time, and he asks you for a quarter, and you feel sorry for him, and you give him some money, and he says, "I like you. I'm going to give you $10 million. And he reaches inside his inner coat pocket, and he pulls out this tattered, dirty check he's obviously stolen from somewhere. And with a broken pencil, he writes you out this check for $10 million, and he gives it to you. If you're like me, when he's out of sight, you know, you rip it up and you throw it away because you know it's not any good. This guy doesn't even have a quarter. Except that this is one of those guys like Howard Hughes, and the check's good. And people have been laying the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and this program of recovery at my feet since 1971, and I'm tearing the check up and throwing it away. And in 1978, through the grace of God and a tremendous amount of desperation and a lack of options, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I cashed that check. There's a line in the book that it tells you, it explains what happened to me better than anything I've ever heard. It says that life was impossible, and we'd come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of our life as we'd been living it. So when we were approached by those within whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left. Nothing left but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at my feet. And in 1978, there was nothing left, man. I'd been to the rehabs. Before my parents cut me off, they used to send me to some of the best psychiatrists and psychologists. I remember going to these psychiatrists thinking that even though I had a good childhood, somebody must have damaged me somewhere because I felt damaged. You know, I just felt damaged. And I remember I spent a couple years in therapy trying to figure out, you know, what had happened. Maybe my mom didn't give me the pony or something, you know, and it's scarred me. I even went through regressive hypnotherapy with this doctor thinking I must have blocked something out, you know. I never found out what it was. I thought if I could uncover it, maybe somebody had done something, I'd uncover it. I'd like a kid's toy balloon just to soar into mental health, you know. I never found out what it was because I have a spiritual malady of alcoholism and I cannot treat a spiritual illness with psychological means. I have a soul sickness that drives me. And it drove me into alcohol and it drives me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. In 1978, I went on my last run and I ended up in a detox in Las Vegas, Nevada. I was running from the law. I was trying to make it to California. Thought I could get lost out here. This is as far as I got was Las Vegas, Nevada. And the Buddhists say when the student's ready, the teachers appear. And members of a group called the Floating Big Book Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I am a proud member of to this day, brought meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous into that institution that I was in. And if there's anyone in this room that's involved in H&I and you go out of your way to carry the message to the homeless shelters and the detoxes and the county jails, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. Because it's the people like you that kept going to the places where people, very few people recover, carrying a message that they never knew would be delivered, that eventually saved my life. And I met my sponsor and the members of this group, and I got out of there and I started following them around. And I started doing whatever they were doing. And I started to get introduced into a program of Alcoholics Anonymous that's outlined in the Big Book. My group's not big on anything else. We're big on the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am so grateful that I got exposed to AA the way it's written in that book, because I wouldn't be here today if it wouldn't have been for that. I started forging a weapon that I never knew I was going to need until I needed it. And if I would have done anything less in Alcoholics Anonymous than I would have done, there would have come times in my sobriety when alcoholism would have eaten my lunch. I'll tell you something that happened to me in my 11th year of sobriety. My 11th year of sobriety, I'd been married at that time for 4.5 years to a gal I met in AA. We had a daughter. She was a year and a half old, the love of my life. I'd never been married before, and I was at a time in my life where I just got a chance to take over this corporation, and I was building this business, and I was required to work a lot, and One of my character defects is that I become sometimes so self-centered that I get like blinders on, and I don't pay attention to anything that is outside my attention and focus. So a lot of times I don't notice what's going on around me. If you don't wave flags in my face, I don't get it, because I'm so wrapped up in what I'm thinking about, what I'm doing. And I'm building this business, and the marriage is starting to grow apart. And finally, one day, at 4.5 years of sobriety, my wife comes to me and she says, I don't want to do this anymore. I want out. And it blew my mind. I said, whoa, it was like a flag. I said, let's try to work this out. We tried some marriage counseling. And we went for several months to this marriage counselor. And at that time, my first sponsor had retired, and he bought this big motorhome, and he was somewhere on the East Coast on this extended several-month vacation driving around this motorhome. So my confidant became this guy that I sponsored, who we were really close. He was my best friend. And he was the guy I shared all my marriage problems with. And finally, after several months of this marriage counseling, my wife comes to me and she says, I don't want to go to the counseling anymore. I'm done. I want out. And in Las Vegas, if you don't contest it, you can get a divorce quick. And we were divorced on a Thursday, and the next day, Friday, my wife and my daughter moved in with my best friend. And I found out that they had been sleeping together for the last year of my marriage, and everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous knew about it except me. Now here I am in my 11th year of sobriety. You guys have been telling me for 11 years there's no such thing as a justifiable resentment. Yeah, well look, wait a minute here. Wait a minute here. I mean, that's the AA party line, but this is different. And I could even find people in Alcoholics Anonymous who would agree with me. Oh, I have an intuitive, sick ability to walk into a room with 100 people and just know the people to go to that are going to just say the things that my disease wants to hear. They'll say things to me like, and Bob, didn't you just buy her a new car? I go, and the holes would open a little larger from the nail wounds, you know, and from the cross, you know. And there's a certain amount of ego gratification in that for a short period of time. But the problem is that if you're an alcoholic of my type and you have the spiritual malady of alcoholism that I got, living inside of that state of resentment and separation, I get real sick. And I started getting afraid for my life because I could not get it out of my head. And I would hear, I'd hear wacko advice in AA. I mean, people would come up to me. Sometimes they'd line up after meetings to give me advice, you know. People would say things to me like, well, just don't think about it. What? Well, shoot me, will you? Or they'd say, or one guy says to me, he says, if you believed in God, this wouldn't be a problem. Well, what? I believe in God. I believe in God, but this is a problem. And God loves me very, very much. And I'll tell you, I look back now and I'm amazed at what happened in my life. He threw swarms of sick new people at me. Swarms of them. And they were all going through divorces and relationship breakups. I mean, I'd stick them in my car and we'd go to meetings. We'd be like, be the depressed section of the meeting, you know? You could hear the secretaries telling the chairman, you know, oh, don't call on them. They're going to get into that, you know? But those guys gave me islands in my day where I would get so wrapped up in what was going on with them that I would get a little bit free from the bondage of self. Until I could eventually come back and go through the steps again as they're outlined in the big book. And there's a part, I did that fourth step and it changed my life. I got to that fourth step and I had to list their names on that resentment sheet and I asked what they did and I had a whole list of, you know, all the things that they did. What was threatened, hurt, affected, or interfered with? Everything. My pride, my self-esteem, my pocketbook, my ambitions, my personal relationship. Everything was threatened, hurt, affected, and interfered with. And then the book says something that I think it is the most miraculous paragraph in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and probably the most healing part of the four-step process. It says, this was our course. And in the original manuscript, it says, you must realize at once how the person who had harmed you was perhaps like you, spiritually sick. And I had to do something
that is very difficult for a self-obsessed, judgmental person like myself. I had to put myself in their shoes and look at me through their eyes and see what it must have been like to be in that marriage, standing in my wife's shoes with everything that was going on inside of her. And when I did that, I found myself standing in the shoes of a woman who came from an alcoholic home with a strict disciplinarian father who was absolutely incapable of confrontation. So when she started to become dissatisfied with the marriage and thought I was gone too much or too wrapped up in other things, she couldn't tell me. And I started to get a sense of her loneliness and desolation in that marriage. And I started to see how all of a sudden she's married to a guy, she's made her whole life around this guy, and the truth is he's just not there much. He's working 70 hours a week, he's sponsoring all these guys, and he's all these committees, and he's just not there much. And I'd like to tell you that that was really what was going on, and that was. I was sponsoring a lot of guys, I was forced to work a lot of hours, but I got to also tell you the truth, is that I don't know how to do intimacy very well, and all that stuff was real convenient for me. It was very convenient to stay busy. And I became what it talks about in the family afterwards. There's a term in there. It says, we become emotionally inaccessible. And I did that because I don't know how to do it any other way. And when I could stand in my wife's shoes and then stand in his shoes, I thought to myself, my God, I could see exactly how I'd done the same thing. Maybe I'd have even done it sooner. And then I was able to come back and look at my part. Where was I selfish? My God, the whole thing was about me. I was so wrapped up in myself that I never once paid attention. I never was once considerate of another person. Where was I dishonest? Where was I resentful? Where was I was afraid? Where was I to blame? I set the whole thing up. And I started entering into a process of amends with them. And they got married and they're doing great. I got to tell you, I have the best stepdad for my daughter. If God walked in this room right now and said, you could pick anybody for a stepfather in the whole world, who would you pick? I'd pick Craig. He's a wonderful stepdad. And in the process of this healing that came from the fourth step and repairing the damage and the separation that I'd created and taking them off the hook and bringing them back into my life, we started to become close friends. And we just buddying around. We'd go to my daughter's ball games and her concerts and her school things, and we started hanging out a little bit once in a while. And years go by, and about the reason I'm talking about it, it's about 6 months ago, I get a call from my ex-wife. And she says, Bob, I need your help. I got a problem with Katie. We're always at odds with each other. We're fighting a lot. And I think that's something that happens when a gal gets to be 11 or 12 years old with her mom. It's part of the deal, right? And she says, I want to go take her to a counselor, and I made an appointment, and the counselor wants you to come. Would you come? I said, I'd be glad to come. When is it? She told me the date, and that was one of the days I was going to be with my daughter. So Katie and I went and got some yogurt, and we went over. We got to the counselor's office, and we got there early, and Craig and Karen got there early, and we're sitting out in the waiting room, and we're hugging and laughing, and we're talking about people. We're gossiping a little bit. We're having a good time. And I look up, and this woman's standing in the doorway looking at us. And she's looking at us, and she says, well, why don't you come in, Dr. Nichols, why don't you come in my office and have a seat? And we started telling her about the problem, and she said, it's not a big problem, it's a communication thing, we can work through this with Katie and her mom. And before we go on any further, I want to take a family history. So we just started telling her the whole deal. I mean, we put it in such a words as to kind of protect Katie, but the therapist knew what we were talking about. And we just told her the whole deal. And after about a couple minutes of this, she puts the pencil down and she's looking at us. And she says, I've been doing marriage counseling for 30 years. I've never seen anything like this. She says, I've seen a lot of families where there's been infidelity and I've had to get them all here over the kid in the office and you could cut the tension with a knife. You guys are like a nuclear family. You love each other. I'm like, yeah. She says, how did that happen? And we told her, we said, well, we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're, because of AA, we're sort of in the alcoholism, we're forced to do some things that I guess really AA is responsible. And she got this funny look on her face and she said, you know, I don't know too much about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm just starting to learn. My daughter just got 6 months. And I got goosebumps when she said that because I thought, what a tremendous instrument God has made the four of us sitting there. And we didn't walk in there trying to be an instrument to help this guy, this gal. We didn't walk in there trying to be an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. We walked in there as a result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous working in our lives and our mutual love for each other as drunks, as human beings, and the mutual love we have for my daughter. And this woman saw an example of Alcoholics Anonymous that couldn't have been better. Because her daughter, as far as she might have been concerned, just joined some kind of cult or something. She don't know what's happening. And here she sees a tremendous example of AA and the three of us. I want to talk a little bit about sponsorship before I quit. I'm almost done. I got a sponsor who I know beyond a shadow of a doubt is the right sponsor for me. A couple years ago, my mom died, and she died of a horrible, horrible illness. She had lung cancer and emphysema, and I would go over there. It was part of my ninth step, an extended version. I thought I was done my ninth step until she started to get sick. And I realized that I went over there, and I'd sit with her and feed her, and then later had to change her diapers and clean up after. And it was a tough, tough thing, but it was a privilege to do it. And my mom died, and she left a modest estate to my sister and myself, were the only two surviving relatives. And she left a will, and in the will, she said she wanted everything split 50-50 between me and my sister. And she left an estate, it was like about $250,000 in Naveens and mutual funds and stocks and bonds and stuff like that. It was all in different securities. And about a day or so after my mom's death, my sister comes into my office and she hands me an envelope with some old dollar bills in it, which was the last of had my name on the envelope in my father's handwriting, was the last of my father's coin collection. And she hands it to me and she says, "Mom wanted you to have this and she wanted me to have everything else." Well, my head was getting noisy when she said that, as you can imagine, right? But I'd been around Alcoholics Anonymous long enough to learn what it talks about in step 10 and the 12x12 to cultivate the restraint of tongue and pen. So I didn't say nothing. I kept my mouth shut. I wanted to say a lot. And I started talking to people in AA about it. And I talked to some people that were sober a long time, over 30 years. And they would tell me things like, "Man, don't let her get away with that. You got to stand up for yourself. You're not a doormat. You get an attorney. You take that will to court. You got to get your half. That's what you're supposed to have, et cetera, et cetera." I had a lot of people tell me that. I went to my sponsor, and my sponsor said, "Give it to her." Boy, I wanted another sponsor about that time, I'll tell you. But inside me, deep down in that place where God lives, I knew he was right. He said things to me like, "That's not your money. You didn't earn it." And I didn't. "You don't need it. Money's not your problem." Money's not my problem. I have a company that produces more money than I can spend. My children's children will never want for anything. I don't need the money. And I said, "Okay, I'll let her have it." And it came to pass. And I told her, I said, it's fine. And it came to pass that when she wanted to cash in all the stocks and bonds and mutual funds and the Naveen and everything, they all wanted certified copies of the will. And they all started sending me half automatically. And I start getting these checks in the mail, right? So I call up my sponsor. He says, "What should I do with them?" He says, "Offer to give them to her." So I said, "Do you want them?" And she said something. She says, "No." She says, "Maybe I was wrong. Maybe Mom really wanted you to have those." You see, my sister wasn't as well off financially as I was. She wasn't hurting, but she wasn't as well off as I was. And my mother was always her backup. She always knew that if she ever got in a jam, my mom was good for $1,000 or $2,000. And when my mom died, the financial insecurity that must have overtook her was probably overwhelming. And you know something? I am the type of person that when you get me afraid, I'm liable to act badly. I may not like myself for it, and I may do some things that are harmful to other people, but believe me, I am capable of that, just as my sister is. And thank God that I had a sponsor that told me to. See, I could have went to court, I could have fought her over that thing, and I would have ended up with the same thing, except I would have lost my sister, my only surviving relative. And several months later, my sister went through a divorce. And she was living in Las Vegas, and I was really all she had. And if I'd have fought over that deal and done what my self-centered fear told me to do, did, Thank God for good sponsorship. Thank God. Because I have a mind that just reacts to self-centered fear. I heard a guy say one time, and it was the most profound thing I ever said. He said, I have never been hurt by my problems as much as I've been hurt by my solutions to my problems. And you would think, with over 20 years of sobriety, that I'd become, all of a sudden, I can think healthily. You know, I can't trust my thinking. You get me afraid or upset or resentful, and I'm going to make bad choices. Because I'm going to, if you get me depressed, and ask, and I'll make depressing conclusions about my life. That's what I do. And thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm gonna tell you a quick story. I'm gonna close with this. It sum up my whole life. Some of you probably heard this. I've been telling this for a lot of years. There's a guy, and he's sitting in an easy chair a Sunday afternoon. He's got the day off, and he's reading the newspaper. And he's got a 6-year-old daughter, and she's running up. She says, Daddy, please play with me. Please play with me. He says, no, not now, sweetheart. I want to read the paper. And she won't go away. She says, Daddy, please play with me. And in the paper, there's an ad for an airlines. And it's a full-page map of the world showing where these planes fly. And he gets an idea. He tears out the map of the world. He tears it up into little pieces. He grabs a roll of scotch tape, and he says, sweetheart, here's a puzzle. It's a map of the world. Take it in your room. If you can put it together, bring it back, and I'll play with you for the rest of the day. She goes squealing down the hall with glee. He sits back in his chair. He figures he's off the hook. She's 7 years old. She don't have a shot. 10 minutes later, she comes back. She's got the map taped together perfectly, and he says, my God, sweetheart, how did you do that? And she says, it's easy, Daddy. On the back was a picture of a man, and when I put the man together, the world just kind of fell into place. And if you're new, I beseech you to grab a sponsor who's grounded in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, who's grounded in the activities of service in this program, and get involved, get all wet in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I will guarantee you a miracle beyond your belief, a world that you never really felt like you fit in, a world that was alien and hostile to you, that you had to drink at, will become the most incredible place you've ever seen. Thank you.